The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. And today, we are going to continue our discussion back a few weeks ago, anyway, on the question of agriculture and agrarianism as a moral idea and a way to reconstruct European Christendom, both of Western and Eastern background. And at least for a while, I want to talk about the agrarian mentality. And this is an overarching mentality that comes from the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the American transcendentalist and writer, who was also a very strong agrarian. Now, this doesn't necessarily endorse everything that Emerson stood for. Nevertheless, his writings on solitude and the agrarian life, the agricultural life, are first class, and they deserve to be taken seriously. And I, you know, from a personal point of view, I really want to hold that. I think that both the Russian and Ukrainian Orthodox ideas very strongly, very tightly connect with the agricultural worldview. And that the two are really essentially two sides of the same coin. And I think that's going to become clearer as we go along. Nevertheless, I do want to hold that agrarianism, to a great extent, resists any real kind of serious ethical or philosophical theory building. I mean, I just want to say that agrarianism is a way of thought, a way of life, a way of feeling, a very home-based and hearth-based kind of way of life. It isn't a dry philosophy that you could write books on. The books and even the poetry and the verse that goes into the agrarian world, this only really picks up a small part of what the agrarian lifestyle and worldview really is. It's something that is ultimately lived and is something that is communicated to others really by love and devotion, not necessarily by prose or even poetry. Although poetry, of course, really comes closest to giving us a strong sense of what the agrarian life, is really all about. I want to make 10 points initially that come from the collected writings of Emerson relative to agriculture and the agrarian life. And I think these 10 points, as closely as, you know, prose writing can possibly bring, can bring us a strong sense of what agrarianism really is, especially as a means of reconstruction. And I want to urge my listeners to really strongly consider, if you live in an urban or a suburban environment, to see what you can do about getting out. The good thing about moving to an agrarian area, as I've done myself, is that it's much, much cheaper, that you know that you're revitalizing a small town and a county when you do that. And even buying land and property in small town America or wherever it is you live, is very, very important, to social reconstruction. And, you know, that's loaded with moral and political activity. The idea of revitalizing, small towns, that are suffering very, very badly and are exploited very, very badly, in the American case and no doubt in other countries as well, especially in Europe. And I've done it myself. And I tell you, it's really an extraordinary experience. You can over the first few months where you move from an urban or a suburban environment, and I've lived in both, when you move to the country, slowly but surely, you feel a lot of strength returning, both physical and mental. As you're breathing that clean air, and as you're working in your yard, and usually we have very big yards out here, and I do myself, because land is very inexpensive. And this kind of exercise, it's tremendously invigorating. And a lot of people that I know who have moved to agrarian areas, after the first few years, they are able to do with less sleep than they did before. They are much stronger mentally and physically. They are much better off financially, because most of our people who live in the suburbs, they sell their house, they move to the country. Usually they could buy their house cash because it's so much less expensive. They're just mentally and physically more vigorous. I have experienced that, and many of my friends have experienced that. So I want to stress that, that wherever you live, in whatever country, in which you live, you need to, if at all possible, see about buying land in a home, in the countryside. And where I live in Amish country here in Pennsylvania, there is no crime. There is an excellent, education system, both public and private. The Amish are everywhere, and they really, theologically, the Amish are off their rocker. But in terms of giving an example, especially to the women, giving an example about how to live and how to be happy, is really something that we should take very seriously. And I'm very, very happy I did this. And I want to stress that if you can do it, please try it. Do it. You will not be sorry. It's invigorating in ways that a city dweller does not understand. Okay. I want to talk about, Ralph Emerson in agriculture, and I want to make 10 general points that he brings up in his collected writings on the agricultural life. By the way, I don't know off the top of my head if there is a collected agricultural set of works by Emerson. I've just read a whole bunch of stuff and gleaned that which is connected to the agrarian world. But if any of you have the energy, I strongly recommend the possibility of collecting all of Emerson's work on the agrarian life and putting it together in one volume. If it hasn't been done already, that would be a worthwhile project. Point number one, and it's a simple point, and the point has been made many, many times in the past, that all economic life really is based on farming. And I don't think that that's all that controversial, because farming produces all of the food and calories and the energy that we consume as human beings. The closer food is to the land, the better it is for you. The farther away it is from the land, the worse it is for you. And then when I say farther away, I mean food that has been processed and processed and processed to the point where it bears no resemblance whatsoever to any kind of natural substance. So I really don't think that many people would deny that the agrarian life is the very foundation of all economics, of all production. Point number two. God is the first cause of all that exists. God is a God through his Son, the Logos, is that which holds all things together and makes all things what they are. Because we live in a fallen world, we have this concept called becoming. That weird intermediary concept between pure potential and pure actual. And everything is in a process of becoming. But as far as our world is concerned, God is the cause of all things, and therefore is the cause of all becoming. Emerson holds to the view that the farmer stands nearest to this first cause than anybody else. A farmer could actually see the Logos functioning in plants, in animals, fertilizer, etc. Can see relative non-being come to relative being. And this is one of the reasons I think that agrarian communities, no matter where in the world they might be found, are the most religious of all. I think the main reason is because they stand close, very close, to the causal chain of creation. Point number three, Emerson holds that cities victimize its people. Cities force people into an artificially fast and harsh rat race, and the country remains, as crippled as it is in the modern world, the country remains for all people who are victimized by city life. I know several city dwellers who have kind of struggled to afford land out in the countryside, who, when they first move out to a remote area and they begin exercising outside and even begin planting and raising animals and things like that, that they feel very, very sick at first. They cough a lot, they spit up a lot, and the main reason for this is that their bodies, their lungs and their systems have built up such layers of impurity and pollution that when they actually come to the countryside and begin breathing this air, their bodies slowly but surely begin to reject the impurities that have invaded it. And they wind up, in some cases, very, very sick for several weeks when they first come out here. But all that really is essentially it's a hangover. It's a hangover for all the impurities that you have forced your body to deal with in the suburban or urban environment. So when you come out here, you end up very sick. You cough a lot up. You end up spitting up. You end up vomiting quite a bit. I've heard of this, and I know of this to some extent because your body is purging itself now that it doesn't have to constantly process impurities from the air and from the water and from everything else. Point number four, the agricultural life represents the world of necessity. I don't mean logical necessity. I don't mean even causal necessity. I mean that the agricultural life has a tendency to stress that which is necessary for life. Clean soil, clean air, clean water, a very simple natural diet, and a more or less slow pace of life. Slow relative to, of course, the modern suburban society. Normal relative to history. And the problem is, and I think what Emerson is really trying to say here, is that the urban and suburban life create artificial desires and demands. It exists to constantly provoke the passions. The agricultural life and the small town life and this way of thinking, what is really primary is what the human body and the human person needs, not necessarily what it wants. And that is, and I do hold to this, that this is a big distinction between the urban and suburban world on the one hand and the agrarian world on the other. The next point is, concerns the nature of time. That the agricultural world measures time by seasons, by the phases of the moon, and its effect on the natural world. This is, of course, the ancient way of recognizing time. Could be lunar, could be solar, could be solely lunar. It depends on what calendar you follow. But the concept of time is radically different in an agrarian world than in an urban world. The urban world, and it is the Renaissance, and the urban Renaissance in Italy, controlled by the Medici banking family, that created the clock, created our modern clock that creates a completely artificial sense of time. The agrarian mentality views time in terms of the seasons, the weather, and that each chunk of that time is typified by a different set of activities that the human person has to go through in order to continue to survive. So that means that the agrarian life is far more diverse in terms of our activities and how we live on a day-to-day basis than the cubicle jockey in suburbia, where every day is exactly the same And the weather, of course, internally is completely controlled artificially. The next point is that there is a big difference in the agrarian idea of labor versus the urban idea of labor. The agrarian idea of labor concerns work, concerns direct creation in partnership, parallel, so to speak, with the natural world. The urban mentality is one not of creation, but of manipulation. The manipulation of stocks and bonds, prices, currency, money, and of course, other people. So there's a totally different idea of work and labor between agrarians on the one hand and urbanites on the other. The one is cooperation with God and the Logos to bring things out of the earth that nourish the entire world. That's what it's primarily centered on. On the other hand, the urban world, while exploiting the agrarian world and taking advantage of it, on the other hand, it manipulates that which others have created. The agrarian world is that of co-creation with God. The urban world is that of manipulation and exploitation. The next point that Emerson makes is, as I've alluded to before, the idea of exploitation. That no matter what society you are looking at, from ancient Babylon to New York City, and those two areas have pretty much almost everything in common in terms of their parasitic relation to the countryside around them. Political rule from the metropole, from the city, seeks to suppress, assault, and exploit the countryside for the sake of providing cheap food. And I want to say to you that this is where all of the mythology of the country bumpkin comes from. That the city needs to dehumanize those who live in the country for the sake of justifying their exploitation of those who create the food. If those in the countryside are ignorant, toothless country bumpkins, you can then rest very easy at night knowing full well that they are suffering and dying for the sake of you having cheap food. That has been the case from ancient Babylon to New York City. This is why the Talmud makes it very clear that Jews may not, under any circumstances, farm the land. They may not do this. That is for Goyim's slaves to do. The Talmud is very clear on this and actually very repetitive on this. The point of the city is to exploit the countryside. But the process of exploitation always is parallel and runs parallel to the concept of dehumanization. Country people have to be known as bumpkins and ignorant, almost animals, and therefore they can be treated as animals. And that's something that Emerson says, and that really has been a part of agricultural thought for a long time. The urban mentality is a dehumanist mentality. It forces people into categories, categories that justify the exploitation and manipulation of urban elites, of whatever political allegiance. I really don't care. Urbanism is urbanism. And the point is that you could justify the exploitation of the farmer for through the very, very typical urban and very Jewish stereotypes of the hick, of the country bumpkin, and you could hate them. And then, of course, as you saw in the Soviet Union, exterminate them with impunity. The next point is something that comes up in Emerson, but it comes up again and again in all of these urban-centered ideologies from capitalism to Marxism. Capitalism and Marxism have that one thing in common, is that they're both controlled by an urban elite that demands cheap food and that any agricultural surplus be plowed into the building of a mechanized order in the urban areas. Capitalism and communism, of course, are sister ideologies. They are nearly identical except in how they distribute rewards. One distributes rewards based on political connections in terms of capitalist relations, the other on political connections based on party membership. Otherwise, they're exactly the same. Lenin made it clear that he wanted to see an entire planet an entire planet that is unified and integrated as one singular factory. That is also, of course, the final gnosis, the final idea of international capitalism and international communism. It's one and the same idea. The radical division of labor, once you take it to its final conclusion, is the creation of a single global factory run by slaves, maybe comfortable slaves, but slaves nevertheless, and controlled by a tiny elite. Whether you are capitalist or Marxist, it ends up being one and the same. Ultimately, it is the synthesis of all modernism, of all science. This is what modernity and ideology, the production fetish of all modern ideologies, this is its ultimate and final conclusion, and there is no getting away from it. It is constant surveillance, it is constant slavery, it is an acultural, cosmopolitan, oligarchic system of control and manipulation. Slightly less depressing, the last two points, 9 and 10, that Emerson brings out, that truly deserve to be taken very seriously. Nature cycles, the cycles of nature, the death, life, rebirth, death, life, rebirth, etc., that these are as close to perfection as humankind could ever come close to. It is the perfect community. It is something that in and of itself is creative of the institutions of community and mutual aid. We all live the same life. We're all subject to the same divinely sanctioned rules of time. We are one people and we assist one another. And the last point, the last concept here is that nothing is ever wasted. In a true agrarian world, everything, every object has its use and its purpose. All goes back to all. And I want to make it very clear here that while these might give you a glimpse of what the agrarian world really is, it really is only a series of slogans that I've kind of strung together to give you a glimpse of really the moral and physical superiority of the agrarian world. And I've lived, and I've said this before, but I've lived in all forms of society, agrarian, suburban, urban, even on the beach, where I grew up on the beach, actually, in New Jersey. And the fact is that when you come to the rural life, changes will come over you, very positive changes, in terms of energy, clarity of thinking. You will suddenly feel very spiritual, even if you haven't been very spiritual before. When you come out to the country, things will change. That I could promise you. It may be a difficult, maybe a difficult adjustment, really. And I know, as I said before, I know some people who have gotten sick because their bodies are now eliminating all of the impurities that have built up over decades in the city. But once you come out of that, you really are a new man. And I could promise you that. Anyway, when we come back from the break, we will continue this topic, although in a very different vein. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking again about agrarianism and the agrarian life. In the first half of the program, we spoke of Ralph Waldo Emerson and his views on agrarianism, and we're going to shift gears here, and we're going to go back to a writer who should be a lot more famous than he is. For the most part, he has been removed from most libraries, academic and otherwise. His name is Eli Bates, and he wrote a book on rural philosophy in 1811. Eli Bates is a deadly serious scholar of philosophy and moral life, and his view of rural philosophy is very hard to find. It's a very rare piece of work, and I want to talk about his general approach for the next few minutes. Eli Bates was a public man and an urban individual and intellectual who moved to the country in disgust from what the city life really was. And he starts off really his philosophical enterprise in a social moral point of view by saying that public life, the life of the politician, the life of political activism, is very, very difficult, if not impossible, for truly honest scholarly men. Because public life is based on deception. Public life is based on money and control and manipulation. But if you're an honest man, if you're an honest scholar, if you're a good man, if you're a virtuous man, you really can't bear to live in that kind of a world. And so Eli Bates retreats to the countryside and writes Rural Philosophy in 1811, and really, you know, when you read this thing, it should alter your way of life. I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that Eli Bates's work is available on Google Books. If you put in rural philosophy and hit full view only, Eli Bates' 1811 work should come up. Eli was not a poor man, but he claims that the life dedicated to money and gain and production is, and it contains in and of itself, a blatant contradiction. You think, on the one hand, that money is going to solve your problems. You could pay your bills, you could pay your creditors, you could get people to do whatever you want. The problem is that the way of getting and keeping money usually keeps you occupied for the rest of your life. Eli Bates, St. John Chrysostom, St. Ambrose, so many other people in history, maintaining the classic Christian idea of money, says that it's based on a contradiction. You think that money's going to solve problems, and yet you realize that the more money you make and the more prominent you become, the more problems you have. It's not just a matter of making money and what you have to do to make money. It's also about keeping it, and not merely keeping it in an economic sense, but also all of the obligations you then have as a social individual. That these things eventually create new problems, problems that you may never have known ever existed. And so someone like Eli Bates and lots of other people who retire to the country disgusted with urban life and the political life of the capital city or the provincial urban center, they realize that once they go to the country, they become independent people. They don't have to worry about what people think of them anymore. Finances become much, much easier because things are just generally cheaper in the countryside. That slowly but surely what you think you want, what you think you need, slowly becomes less and less. And Emerson says the same thing. Farming is really about necessities. Urban life is about what you want, what you desire, what you demand. So the desire for money is based on a contradiction. Eli Bates makes it clear that public life, I don't care what country you live in, I don't care what era you live in, public life is based not on ability, not on intelligence, not on virtue. Absolutely not. I lived and worked in Washington, D.C. for years. It is based on patronage and who you meet and who your friends are. That is what it's based on. That is not only what hiring is based on, but what promotion is based on. And even worse than that, people like Eli Bates learn from substantial public life, whether it be in a capital or a provincial city, that the public is just as bad as their rulers. The public are just as greedy and demanding and nasty and superficial as the rulers are. Public life, the life dedicated to money and production, is the worst, most irrational life you could possibly ever lead. Even success does nothing but create problems. Success creates as much vulnerability as poverty does. The minute somebody becomes successful, they become a target. That's the case in economics. That's the case in politics. This is why so many people will just simply throw up their hands and say, forget it, Eli Bates and yours truly. But the rural way of thinking, the country way of thinking, if you are to succeed there, it is based on hard work, self-control, and virtue. That's the difference. You can function in the city as a fraud, as an illusionist, and you could do very, very well there. You can't pull that crap off in the country. A successful farmer can't be a fake. A successful farmer can only be a hard-working, common sense man, period. You know, Eli Bates mentions, he talks about theology a little bit, and I don't really know what his religious background is, but he makes the claim, and I want you guys to think of this. Our attraction to the agrarian life, I mean, even if it's just the romantic feelings that we have when looking at a beautiful picture of an old rustic bridge or carriage or horses or a field, where does that romance come from? Why do we feel uplifted when we look at a beautiful picture of the mountains or a clear stream out in the country? I mean, even the hardest core urbanite feels something when they look at a picture or read a poem about something like that. It's because Eden, paradise, really did exist. Many, many cultures around the world posit the existence of the Garden of Eden. They may not call it that, but it's the same concept. That somehow mankind abused their freedom and got kicked out of it. I mean, this exists all over the place. Not just in Christianity or in Islam. I mean, it exists everywhere. That suggests to me, empirically, that it did exist at one time or another. And we really all belong there. That's what we're made for. And that's where that feeling, that inexpressible, unexplainable feeling comes from, when even your really hard-bitten urbanite looks at a picture or a painting of the rural life. Something happens. Even for a split second, something changes. Eden was meant to be dressed and kept. In other words, Adam and Eve and anybody else who lived in paradise, they worked. And it wasn't work that hurt them. It wasn't work that made them sweat and get sick and get cramps. But it was work in the best sense of the word. It was a true vocation to dress and keep the garden. The Garden of Eden was a temple. It was the very first church. What we're talking about here is labor in the non-alienated sense, the true labor of love. And that's why so many people, the most virtuous and intelligent of people, are drawn and dedicated to this way of life and this way of thought. Eli Bates holds that the pleasures of rural life are based on the idea that man is himself a microcosm of the natural world. He has reason and logic connected to the logos and the natural laws that connect all natural objects, as well as being a natural object himself. He sees himself in everything natural. He sees power and domination in everything artificial, like a skyscraper. Two totally different lives. The man who is passionate, the man who is demanding, the man who lives for his lusts, he could never enjoy rural life. He could never make sense out of rural life because rural life condemns that sort of person. Those sort of people exist to drive, to enslave, and to dominate. But in the rural world, the rational man, the moral man, the virtuous man cannot dominate anything. He lives as a partner, not a master with the natural world. That's why slavery and feudalism, serfdom, are so vile. They're so unnatural because the exact opposite exists in the rural world. But it's very much a part of our fallen post-Eden state. Eli Bates holds that our retreat, I mean, even if you live in the suburbs and you have a retreat out in the country or up in the mountains, that is far healthier than simply exclusively dedicating yourself to the suburban world. Eli Bates holds that the rural retreat is a place of reflection and contemplation. Those are the opposite virtues of the urban and public life. In the urban world, what you care about is control. In the country, what you care about is truth and contemplation. And that moral philosophy, the philosophy of virtue, is better than science. Because science is about controlling nature and dominating nature. Virtue is about having the mentality that can take you through and get you through any bad time. The Old Testament prophets make it very clear that there is a big distinction between the worship of the one God and paganism. Paganism is about control. Paganism is about money and passion. It's about sex and devotion and obsession. It's about dominating those around you. On the other hand, the worship of the one God is not so much to control that which happens, but to give you the strength to endure anything that might happen to you and to your family. Moral deeds, the virtuous man deals in truth. Natural philosophy or science attempts to manipulate truth. It attempts to use it. Sophistry is the world of the city. Truth is the world of the country. What people like Eli Bates want to say is that there is more ontological and metaphysical truth in visiting and helping your elderly neighbor than there is in all of the self-absorbed academic obsessions with promotion and publication that exists in the universities. We want to go back to Eden. All of us do. I have always held to the view, especially when I had kids. When I had kids, a very painful and powerful truth came to me. That painful truth was that child abuse exists because individuals see in children a pale reflection of Eden. They have been kicked out of Eden, and they don't have the mentality to go back. And so they lash out in hatred. I'm absolutely convinced of that idea. I'm convinced of the innocence of the young child, and that therefore the only place for the young child is in the countryside. Young kids, I'm saying maybe like from 2 to 7, maybe 6. In my experience, they could hear the angels singing. My kids always said that. My kids are very intelligent, very high-achieving children. One day my wife said to my oldest, during church one day, she said, you know, you're almost 10 years old. You're getting to the point where you won't be able to hear the angels sing anymore. And, you know, I'm not one for these kind of flights of fancy or these kind of romantic ideas. I really am not. I'm actually very hard bitten and a very difficult pain in the neck, but there was a metaphysical truth there that these innocent children, they can hear things and they can see things. I've always believed that the imaginary friend of the little kid is really an angel. It's a guardian angel. I've always believed that. These things don't come from nothing. But the rural world is one place where the young people can always hear the angel singing. I haven't heard it because I'm too hard bitten. I've been through too much and I'm an urbanite, you know, but I moved my family to Amish country, Pennsylvania, and I'm here to tell you that they are very happy, vigorous individuals. Very strong. Very strong Irish Christian people. And I beg of you, please at least consider the idea that we can move to the country. We can revitalize the small town. We can begin again. We can get as close to Eden as the human being can. If we truly have faith in the Logos, in the regularity of natural law, and that we can actually see it growing and see it developing. We see our crops growing and we see our kids growing. I mean, what more kind of integration? What more kind of unity can you want under these circumstances? People like Eli Bates say that visiting your elderly neighbor and helping her around the house, that this has more philosophical truth than all of these sick, screwed up, alienated academics in the universities pretending that they know something. Nothing can be truer than that. My little kids do hear the angels singing. I know that they do. But I don't. And I don't because I grew up in the sick environment of modernity. And all I could do is pray and struggle as much as I can. And who knows, maybe one day I'll be able to hear it again. Anyway, I thank you for listening. I appreciate everything that you've done. I appreciate your support for me over this last year that I've been here at VOR. And I want to thank everyone, Mishko and Dietrich and of course, Mike and Steve and everyone who's helped me here. I appreciate everything they do. And until next time, hang in there, folks, and we'll be talking again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Oh!
Amen.